Look at the adjective. Play.
I respect you, Booker man.
And I have half the brain that you do.
Run! That's
shot!
I told you. Hold on.
Now is the franchise going to take the Viagra?
Gonna put some butts in the seat.
Hello there, wrestling fans, and welcome to episode number 5 of Because WCW, the podcast where the big boys play. I am the Twisted Genius, Dean Ayers, joined as ever by my co-host, sports journalist, and lifelong WCW fan, Liam Happ. How are you doing, Liam?
To be honest with you, Dean, I'm a little bit nervous.
do tell our millions of listeners why.
Well, you know, those who saw the vote we had to decide which event we're covering on episode 5 will know that this is our first Russo pay-per-view. Yay. And this is going to drain us, Dean. This is going to absolutely drain us more than a Hogan Warrior, more than a really tepid undercard on the 1992 WCW pay-per-view. This is going to be tough, man.
Well, we said, you know, about Halloween Havoc that we watched it so you don't have to, but in this case, we really did watch it so you don't have to. And for the sake of full disclosure, I've got to say, I had to watch this in 3 chunks. My brain couldn't take watching the whole thing in 1 3-hour slot, which is the first time that's happened. I got through all of Havoc 98 in one go. My brain was hurting like within an hour of Starrcade 99.
Yeah, so for some weird masochistic reason, I rewatched this pay-per-view not long after I got access to the WWE Network. And maybe that's the thing, maybe it's a kid in the candy shop situation.
Why?
Where,
Why would you want to do that?
If you put a kid in the candy shop with all those pay-per-views, all that content, the kid's going to make themselves sick in the candy shop. And, well, that's exactly what I did. You know, I kept watching and watching and watching, and then everybody else started watching awful stuff. So I think that's where I went wrong. And
so what, you got through the good stuff and you're like, what's left?
But yeah, I just took a wrong turn or convinced myself it weren't as bad as it really, really was. But the point is that was the last time I watched it. I actually remembered what happened. I had a little flick through the results to remind myself of the event. And I voluntarily neglected to watch it again.
So basically what we're saying is that Starrcade 99 is like the bounty bars in the box of celebrations.
Hey, yeah. I like bounties. I do not like Vince Russo.
Oh, I like it. Now, I've worked on a couple of shows with Vince Russo. He worked over in IPW UK a couple of years ago. And, I mean, I didn't have anything to do with him from a business perspective at all. But, you know, as a human being, he came across as a very nice bloke to me. Very, you know, nice, pleasant, professional man. So, but...
Bro! Tell you about it? It's not my fault, bro. Everyone else is to blame but me, bro.
But,
was it like that?
He wasn't, no. He was much calmer than that. But I've got to say that from a wrestling philosophy point of view, we are polar opposites. One other thing before we do get started. We have had some behind the scenes technological difficulties, shall we say.
Enough to make WCW themselves blush.
For those of you who aren't aware, or those of you who might be listening for the first time, I live in Brighton. Liam lives in London. It's about, 50, 70 miles away. So, yes. So we do this by Skype. And our first few episodes, you know, the sound wasn't all that great. I sounded like I was speaking from a distant toilet cubicle. And by episode 4, we'd nailed it, hadn't we? We'd got that down.
We had. That being said, I just assumed you were in the toilet cubicle. I can't believe that wasn't the case.
No, sorry. So if only you'd have clicked the video option, you'd have known.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. and then all of a sudden, you've got booted out of your Skype and have to go to a different Skype account and all the audio's gone.
Yeah, I used to log in via Facebook, and they've just really suddenly decided that's not a thing anymore with the latest Mac up. Yeah, the latest Mac update that actually allows people to log on to your computer remotely as well. If you saw the root issues going around online.
Oh,
so
yes.
It's all round, it's been a fantastic update for Mac. Bastards.
So basically, if you're listening to this and you have got more of a clue about technology than either of us, which isn't going to be too difficult, and you're a Mac user and you can help us get our audio sounding good, then please do contact us on Twitter at becausewcw or facebook.com/becausewcw. But here we go. Let's crack on now with Starcade 1999. Thank you ever so much for downloading this wherever you may be in the world. So before the show begins, and this is probably a little nod to what we have to expect now we're in the Russo era, we have a TVMA, mature audiences 18 plus viewers recommendation to begin, which I've not seen on a WCW show before. And that's then followed by a man, and a very urgent sounding man, maniacally reading out the huge list of stipulations for a number of matches, talking very quickly, you know, like when you'd have, you know, the radio adverts where they have to reel off the terms and conditions in 10 seconds, and he talks very quickly like this, and it just sounds like that. This poor guy has got to reel off all these stipulations within a very short space of time, and this is most definitely a Russo show. And then we have, and you'll be prepared for this because it's going to be a running theme of the show, we have another video package then running through events that led to our two main matches of Nash versus Sid Vicious and Bret Hart v Bill Goldberg.
Yeah, I gotta say, I really like that comparison to those TV adverts with the terms and conditions, because if you think about it, the reason why they run through the T's and C's so fast is to gloss over the drags of the promotion. You know, they're like, oh, you can have this for such a low price, and they're like, oh, it'll cost you something, and you sell your soul to the devil, blah, 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 you know, really fast. And no wonder they use that sort of technique here, because, you know, you don't really want to slow down and listen to all the crap that's been put on this card.
Yeah, I guess these are the terms and conditions of the matches, aren't they? The stipulations.
As Russo always liked to say himself, you forgot to read the fine print, bro.
Yes.
Bro count is at about 27 already, bro.
Already. And those of you who've listened to our previous episodes know we always like to list Tony Schiavone's opening hyperbole. Where he usually says that this is the greatest or most important or most historic match in the history of the world. But this one, he simply says that this is the very last wrestling pay-per-view of the century. And, well, you can't really argue with that. I guess sometimes the calendar does the hype for you.
Yeah, Schiavone going statistically accurate with his commentary. That is, I don't know what Russo did to him, to be honest. But, on the commentary front, I have to point out, I believe this is the pay-per-view commentary debut of one Scott Hudson as well, who I've always had a soft spot for. I like, you know, he can descend into cliche a little bit, but he always had a good voice for it. I always remember listening to him on some of the syndicated shows like Worldwide, and I was always a Scott Hudson fan, so it was nice to hear him on the pay-per-views from time to time.
Yeah, he was like he had a slightly less, Mark Madden was on before him or after him, and his voice was a bit too deep and a bit too distracting. But Scott Hudson, yeah, has an authority about his voice, but not being too deep. I did read somewhere that I'm sure in America, Mark Madden was the voice of Tony the Tiger from the Frosties advert.
Really?
I don't know if I've made that up or not. I'm sure I read it somewhere.
Sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up at some point. I'll tweet that. I'll tweet that from the Because WCW account if I find it. But unlike previous shows, and unlike, think of like Halloween Havoc 98, where the theme was TikTok, TikTok, this one, we don't even go to the commentators. It's probably because we've got 13 matches to go through. So as soon as Schiavone says, you know, welcome to the show, Disco Inferno's music hits, and we get straight into the opening match. And we just get introduced over the audio to Tony Schiavone, Scott Hudson, and Bobby Heenan, even though Heenan doesn't even get introduced over the audio by Schiavone, his voice just comes up and you know it's Bobby Heenan.
Yeah, maybe this was around the point where those two really weren't seeing eye to eye. I won't go on off on a massive side tangent about that, but it's been documented everywhere. Like, obviously Heenan, before he passed away, did some shoot interviews talking about Schiavone in a negative light, and Schiavone has responded to him since, and to a lot of an extent, he admitted that Heenan had a point. At the time, these two did not get on too great, and maybe that's got something to do with it. But I've got to say, I'm a huge fan of the show kicking off. You have an introduction from the announcers. It lasts about 60 seconds max, and then you hear the entrance music of the first combatant. You get straight to the ring. This is a pay-per-view. I know this is going to be defeated pretty quickly, what I'm saying, given it's a Russo pay-per-view. But, you know, it's a pay-per-view. You want to get to the matches. You are building towards a set of matches, and you want mostly action. I'm all for filler on TV. I'm all for, a two-hour show only having half-hour of wrestling, because it's about more than that. But the pay-per-view, let's get to the ring. And the opener was... I don't know what to say about the opener.
Yeah, so the opener is Disco Inferno teaming up with Lash LaRue, who I'd forgotten even existed, I have to say, against the Mamelukes, Big Vito and Johnny the Bull, with the magnificently named Tony Marinara, who later became Tony Mameluke in ECW, I think.
Yes, he did.
I don't know if anyone in Italy actually has the surname of Marinara, or if it's just a source, but... Lash LaRue, as I said, he was a power plant graduate. I looked him up. He retired from wrestling. He's a full-time illustrator and cartoonist now. The backstory here, because obviously every single match here, everything has a big, long backstory to it that usually requires video packages. But Disco Inferno was a gambling addict, and he owed these mafioso-type folk, the Mamelukes, money. And obviously, when someone owes you money, how do you sort it out? You have a wrestling match on a pay-per-view.
Yeah. You sound like you said that sarcastically. That sounds about spot on.
No, not at all. That's how I settle all my problems, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But what really annoyed me here, though, was that on commentary, the Mamelukes are described as goons and thugs, and they're basically portrayed as not even being wrestlers. Which then makes me wonder, first of all, what are they doing on a wrestling pay-per-view having a wrestling match? And if they're not wrestlers, why are they executing chin locks and running the ropes, or at one point hitting a very good double hip toss, double slam combination, double team move?
Yeah, I always love that double team move of theirs. I think later on it becomes like their double team finish, but obviously here it's just the move they pull off. But yeah, it was one of many things I actually liked about the Mamelukes. I'm glad they were tag team champions. I think they would have been a good part of WCW had it been bought out and carried on in 2001. You've got a guy in Big Vito who's been around everywhere. He's making it to the big time. He might, at this point, he's got about 12 years experience already.
I remember him being a jobber on like WCW Worldwide, as I think it was, Skull Von Crush.
Yeah, ECW alumni as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Johnny the Bulls, he's had less than 10 televised matches at this stage. So it's a bit of an odd pairing, but all four of them, I thought, worked hard. And I like their gimmicks and their shtick and the stuff they do personally, but the storyline coming into it, it's just, as you touched upon with the whole gambling mafia, it's like you'll see with a lot of Russo stuff, he's watched some movie and he's decided to to take it and put it into wrestling, which is very much a recurring theme of a lot of the storylines he comes up with, allegedly.
Yeah. And we've also had one thing that's been shown on a video skit, and then two other things that are mentioned in commentary, which is a skit where Disco and Lash LaRue had covered Johnny the Bull even in marinara sauce. Tony Marinara had been tarred and feathered, and Lash LaRue had been put in a body bag. And it's just like throwing all of these gimmicks and all of these skits into this one opening match when one will do, even if one is needed. It's just overloading things, I guess, which again is going to be a theme of this. To me, it was a solid match. The match heated up at the end. The crowd were into Disco Inferno, but that was about it, I felt.
Yeah, you know, each team has got one guy who's hardly been around. They're fresh out in the power plant. And you've got two more experienced guys who've got a bit more charisma. And, you know, it's in the, we always say the opening slot, you want to stick in something where the ring work alone is there. And, it weren't bad in that respect. It got off to a decent enough start until the closing bell rung, I found, and then the crap started.
Yes. So there's a miscommunication between Disco and Lash LaRue. The Mamelukes pick up the win, and then basically Disco Inferno gets beaten up, put in a body bag, put in a car boot, and driven off.
Because one body bag wasn't enough. You're saying about Lash being put on it on Nitro or Thunder, whichever one it was. Yeah. And now we need it on the pay-per-view as well.
Yeah.
And then I won't go too far into the future, but I know with it, by the time we get to the next pay-per-view, Sold Out 2000, which will be a tremendous episode of this podcast down the line, Disco Inferno was the manager of the Mamelukes.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Great. So that's our opener. If you've caught your breath after having all of that information thrown at you by the bookers, we go to the commentators and we're told that that Scott Hall is out with a knee injury and can't defend the US title against Chris Benoit. Now, before we go any further, you know these sort of things, Liam. Was Scott Hall genuinely out with a knee injury, or had something else happened?
Yes, apparently, according to Dave Meltzer, he really was. I think he... I'm trying to remember. I believe it, because he suffered... I think it might have been a groin pull, or... No, it might have been a knee injury that he would favour while still continuing to work hurt, that led to a groin pull. So either that or the two injuries were the other way around. And so it was a legitimate injury.
Oh, okay.
And fair. And to another thing, because this is the sort of thing that Meltzer would be all over if they had done this, but apparently they were transparent. You know, this was quite late on, and they were transparent about the fact that, you know, he won't be showing up, but there will be a ladder match for the US title featuring Chris Benoit. And I believe they had a little thing in the ring earlier in the card to just establish what's going to happen, didn't they?
Yeah, well, this is that segment. Because they announced that WCW have basically just awarded the US title to Chris Benoit, which I'm never a fan of. You know, titles should be won in the ring. Chris Benoit then comes out wearing street clothes with the US title. And he basically said that this is a stupid decision as well, and that, you know, he wants a match. Says that the title's vacant, opens an open challenge for a ladder match. So I'm in two minds about this, because, like you said, on the one hand, they can't deliver the advertised match. They may, you know, they've had heat before for things being switched. So they've basically promised that there will be a ladder match for the US title. But my problem with that is that a ladder match is supposed to be a feud-ending match, and instead we've got a ladder match against a mystery opponent with zero build. So, I mean, I guess, yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't in this situation.
Yeah, because they've advertised a ladder match, so kudos to them for going with it. It's not like, you know, of all the times Russo will throw silly stipulations out too early. In this instance, they did have something brewing with Benoit and Hall, and yeah, so we're going to get a replacement match, and I won't say too much more about that now, because I get a funny feeling that when we're on to match 12 or 13 of this pay-per-view, we're going to need something positive at that stage when we're when we're a lot lower on stamina and a lot lower on the will to live.
Okay, fair enough. We'll move on to match number two, which is for the WCW Cruiserweight title, and it is Evan Courageous, the champion,
God,
being challenged by Medusa.
Now, I remember this.
This is 1999, and I've got to say that, you know, to my knowledge, intergender matches, which are very, you know, reasonably common these days, especially in the independents more than the mainstream, I guess. But intergender matches were virtually unheard of at this time, and we get more than one of them on this show. So, you know, maybe Vince Russo is years ahead of his time. Who knows?
Or maybe he's just trying to replicate what he just had with China in the WWF. And obviously one of the last things he oversaw before he handed in his notice was the China Jeff Jarrett storyline where they actually put a belt, which, you know, even that was a risky thing to do, and she was never going to be suitable to hold that belt for a long time because China never was a fantastic wrestler, but there was enough appeal to do that pop of a title change. But, you know, it worked once with a lot of supervision from Vince McMahon, as usual, and he's decided, right, what's the quickest available opportunity to do that here? Oh yeah, green as grass Evan Courageous, who's just shown up over the last few months and somehow won the cruiserweight title, and at this point probably an over the hill Medusa.
It's an old combination. I mean, Medusa, obviously much more experienced, would be the one that'd lead him through the match. But the story behind this, because obviously there's got to be a story to every match, is that the two of them were dating until Medusa caught Evan Courageous cheating on her with Nitro Girl Spice, who now accompanies Courageous to the ring.
Yeah, and if you can't see where this is going now, you have no business speaking about anything Vince Russo does. You have to see where this is coming.
They try and do the old, the double bridge up spot where you've got them in a waist, one person on top of the other in a waist lock, and they both bridge up. They try that and completely blow that, and the ref has to stop counting. She also nearly drops Evan Courageous on his head with a powerbomb attempt. It's not pretty, let's say that. And the finish sees Spice get up on the apron to distract Courageous with, I don't know if she's meant to be kissing him, doesn't want to, or what, but she's kind of just gyrating in very close proximity to him without actually touching him, and then hits him in the groin, but again misses and doesn't even touch him. Now, I don't know. I don't know if, like, you know, if Nitro Girl Spice was someone who, you know, didn't want to have any kind of physical involvement with a bloke that she wasn't legitimately involved with, or if she just wasn't very good at doing what she was meant to be doing. But it looks really, really awkward. And then while he's being distracted by not being hit in the groin, Medusa hits a German suplex on him for a three count. The whole match is 3.5 minutes, and basically it's telling us that, again, a theme you'll see in Vince Russo booking is that all women are two-faced, untrustworthy slags who you can't spare, you know, you can't trust, or as far as you could throw them, basically.
Yep, racist, misogynistic, and to be fair, you know, I mean, in the opening match, he was racist against some of his own with the Italian stereotypes like marinara. So you can't say he's not an equal opportunity discrimination machine. But yeah, that is the essence of Russo's body of work, isn't it? And yes. You were saying about how Spice was, you know, seemingly reluctant to do aspects of it. I think I know what you mean as far as just the actual gyrating with Evan, but she, you know, it's, I think it was pretty common knowledge at the time that pretty much all the Nitro girls were very reluctant to be having, like, in-ring, on-air roles. And that's another thing that Russo pretty much forced upon them, was as soon as he walked through those doors, suddenly the Nitro girls were in storylines. Kimberly was much more involved with DDP, Ric Flair, David Flair. We'll get to that afterwards. And, yeah, all this stuff is all happening. And, yeah, Spice, that she doesn't only look incompetent at what she does, but it's pretty obvious that she didn't want to be doing it in the first place, in her defence.
Yeah.
The whole match smacks of it.
Yes. And there's more stuff later on that just is horribly awkward. We now come match number three. We're going to have to rattle through these because there are 13 matches to go through.
I'm ticking smiling. Them off. I'm ticking them off like it's like days on a prison wall.
Norman Smiley is next. I loved Norman Smiley. I really did. I thought this was such a funny gimmick.
It was. He has a very short shelf life.
Yes.
But, you know, he does have the personality to pull it off, the whole screaming Norman thing. Yeah. And, yeah, the hardcore division is just such a, like, a naff gimmick. You had the WWE's 24/7 rule, which was fun, but even that only lasted a few months before it got dull. And WCW tried to copy the hardcore thing, and they had a grand total of about 3 matches that were any good. But
and they, you know, they also had that Junkyard Battle Royal where half the roster that were on it got injured.
Oh, I can't wait to cover that one. That's going to be amazing.
But what
no,
was that? can't remember.
That was Bash at the Beach 99. But from a character point of view, yeah, the hardcore division gave, you know, Norman Smiley, who's always entertaining anyway, and he's really put him over the top, and it's a shame nothing more came of it, because, you know, he was mostly a trainer when WCW folded a year later, which and is completely everyone, related to the fact that Russo's running it.
Yes, and now, you know, he's still to this day is still a trainer in the Performance Centre in WWE, and everyone that I know in the Performance Centre just constantly sings his praises. They say, you know, from all accounts, he is the most amazing trainer. And it was just such a good gimmick. He's the hardcore champion who's, in this case, is wearing American football pads and a helmet and is terrified of getting hurt. The only thing I ever wondered with this is, why didn't he just lay down and let himself get beaten so he wouldn't be the champion anymore? But instead, he would always somehow find a way to sneak a victory, which made it even better. So the commentators, as always, mention how tough Meng is, which is very true, but it's never ever seems to have translated to the fans or drawn any money, unfortunately.
No, he kind of just walks out there. You know, he won a fair few of his matches. He'd have dull matches. He put the Tongan death grip on, and that was it. And it was really hard to as you said, it's really hard to turn that into something that people actually take an interest in. You know, they are portraying him as a monster, but he just didn't have that presence of one, even though he was getting all the booking. And he obviously did have the real life reputation, which nonetheless, you know, that's a very small fraction of the audience. But here, he's a good foil for Norman Smiley. You know, Norman's doing his thing. He's screaming every shot. He's running away. And he makes Meng look better as a result. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, they have that. They probably... that must have been about 5 minutes or less, or a fair few of these matches will be. And they just run through the basics of, you know, the baking trays and the trash cans, you know.
Well, this match was, 4 minutes 29 to be precise.
Oh, so, I'm so good.
But it was such a strange thing to watch, because we in this day and age, because, as you said, 1999, it was the peak of the hardcore era. You had, you know, ECW was going pretty well on pay-per-view. You had the WWF hardcore division. It was the peak of that. And this is this sort of bizarre combination of a comedy match, which takes place almost entirely backstage, where both men are basically taking several unprotected shots to the head with, like, rubbish bins or a steel chair on one occasion for Meng. And it's just, knowing what we know now that we didn't know back in 1999, watching it back, it's really uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, to be fair, regardless of who's in charge or what era it is, I feel like you can draw a line around 2007 with You Know What from You Know Who, and the difference is like night and day, and it's a good thing. But yeah, it's hard to label any blame on a particular era, because, you know, even before the Attitude Era, Hardcore Era, there were a lot of wild shots to the head. So it was very much a thing that needed to be wiped out, and it took something so tragic to finally do that. Yeah. And this is just one place where you see it, but yeah, you don't see it for very long.
I mean, it was a different time. You know, I mean, even like 4 or 5 years later, I'm thinking about 2003, 2004, I took two unprotected chair shots to the head in the FWA in the British Independent. And, you know, put my hand up a little bit, but still got waffled and still got, I think on one occasion, got one I was fine, one I got a concussion on. It's just, again, looking back with 2017 eyes on something in the past, it's very different. But basically, this match, just to go back to it, it's all Meng on offense, no selling pretty much everything that Norman Smiley attacks him with. Then Fit Finlay and Brian Knobbs show up, start attacking Meng. Finlay somehow KOs Meng by hitting him across the back with a lead pipe, and Smiley comes out of hiding and pins Meng to retain the title.
And that was my favorite part of this, is the way Norman just crept out of his hiding place. And, you know, even though Meng was actually out cold, like, apparently from this, he still put a very cautious hand on him and then legged it from the unconscious man, which to me, it made the whole thing worthwhile, just the way he covered him. What other match can you think of where the match winning cover, the lateral press, was the best part of the match?
But it's just how good Norman Smiley was with that character.
It really is a testament to that. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and then Men comes round and puts the Tongan death grip on Nick Patrick, who still can't sell convincingly since we last mentioned this, I think, at Starrcade 97 or Halloween 98.
Since every other episode we've done and every episode coming up. It's going to be its own segment.
Yeah, you'd think they'd give like referees the amount of, especially the amount of ref bumps that go on in this show. You think they'd give the ref some sort of training on how to sell being hit, you know? But anyway, we then cut backstage. Guess what? It's a video package. Well, this was actually a backstage skit where a maniacal looking David Flair takes delivery of a golden crowbar. And then we go to Oklahoma, who's a piss take of Jim Ross, basically, played by Ed Ferrara, which is just a horrible gimmick, giving Steve Dr. Death Williams, his manager, his wrestler, a pep talk. We then cut back to the commentators, and seconds later, we cut back backstage again because the Misfits, who are a band and not wrestlers, but they're on this pay-per-view, have seemingly kidnapped Oklahoma, and the poor commentators basically have to sell all of this like it's serious.
Yeah, I'm not even going to try and recap in detail what was going on there, but yeah, it's going to be Vampiro Steve Williams and Oklahoma, and his JR ripoff is obviously the focal point of the feud, because yeah, we know the real star here is right. But yeah, so the Misfits, essentially, you know, with the numbers, and from what I remember from this, from the Nitros and that, they put those numbers to use, and they're the baby faces here. You've got, you know, as much as it shouldn't be on TV in the first place, the least you can say about the Oklahoma character is, you know, it's an obnoxious heel. You're meant to enjoy seeing him get his comeuppance, and yet he's being darted around like 5-on-1. It's like, Let's just get to the match and get over with.
Okay, well, before that match, we've got an eight. Well, I think it's an eight-man tag, I guess. It's never really announced how many people are in this match, but it's the Revolution against Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Mystery Partners.
Yes, is this because Shane Douglas is sort of part of it, but not part of it because he's injured? But you know.
Yeah. We'll hold that thought because it comes into things at the end. But for some reason, Jim Duggan's now wearing this horrible brown boiler suit and is apparently working
as a janitor
while still wrestling in WCW, which I don't know how that had happened. The Revolution, which is Shane Douglas, Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, and a large female bodybuilder called Asia, spelt A-S-Y-A.
Nudge, nudge, hint, hint.
Yes, because Asia's bigger than China.
Yeah.
Get it? Yeah.
Seriously, Russo, fuck off.
He is obsessed, isn't he? Russo is obsessed. He's like the ex-boyfriend who like is, you know, stalking his ex on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everything else, and is, you know, hanging out, walking past her house every day to see if she's still in there or something. It's like, get over it, Russo. You've split up. Move on to the next one. The Revolution appear to be their own sort of independent state with their own flag, it seems. And the stipulation here is that if Duggan loses the match, he has to renounce his US citizenship. And I believe if Duggan wins, then the Revolution have to take over his janitorial duties. Duggan's Mystery Partners turn out to be the Varsity Club, which is the old 1989-1990 NWA gimmick, Mike Rotundo, Rick Steiner, and an ancient-looking Kevin Sullivan. And they're accompanied by Leia Meow, as she's called, the former Kimona Wanalea in ECW, as a sexy cheerleader who's one of a million valets in WCW under Vince Russo.
Yeah, but I liked her. I liked Kimona. It got better because they then moved her on to Young Dragons and she dressed up like a dominatrix. So it gets even better. You think I'm being sarcastic, but no, I thought it was fantastic.
I don't think you're being sarcastic.
Huge fan of Kimona.
How old would you have been at this point?
Old enough for it really to have mattered.
Old enough for the hormones to be racing through you.
Yeah, oh yes. This is a good. It was a good time to be alive.
So this whole, I say the whole match, I mean, it lasted, how long did it last? Let's have a look. It lasted 4 minutes 53, so again, less than 5 minutes.
30 seconds per participant.
Yeah. It's heat on Duggan throughout the whole match, and even the commentators are mentioning how he's ignoring his partners, which kind of telegraphs what's going to happen. And it's just awful. When Duggan... Jim Duggan has come over here for... I've never worked with him, but I've known people who have. He's come over here for UK tours a couple of times, and everyone to a man says he is literally the nicest man you'll ever meet in your life. However, he's 46 by this point in time, and he's just looking his age, basically. It all breaks down into an 8-person brawl, and then the Varsity Club all beat Duggan up for no apparent reason, except that Russo loves swerves.
Well, no, you just to be fair, you did explain why he spent the whole time neglecting them. I don't think he picked them. He was, if I remember correctly, he was assigned them. And the idea was, is he wanted to beat up the revolution. He didn't need partners. He's given partners, okay. But he's like, sod yous, this is my work. And so, like, yeah, we don't take kind to that. So it was, an actual storyline. It was a crap storyline, but yeah, there was an actual deliberate intent into it. But yeah,
I've been so lost in the mire of shit that I'd not seen the actual storyline there. But
that is a very true symptom. The thing is if you do crap like this in every match and every week in every segment, it is easy to get confused with what's going on. Whereas if things are a bit more drawn out and purposeful, people know what's going on, and there's no chance of a miscommunication or a misapprehension.
Yeah. And Duggan is pinned by Shane Douglas, who, as far as I can tell, isn't a competitor in the match because he's got a serious arm injury, but the fall counts anyway. But then he might have been in the match because I don't think the commentators ever really mentioned if he was or wasn't, probably because they didn't know either.
So it was an 8-man, and on the Revolution you would have had Malenko, Saturn, Asia's presumably on the apron as well.
Yeah.
And
I don't think she gets involved in the match, but she's in there.
Douglas, and that'll be four.
But Douglas, I don't think, is on the apron. I didn't see him there.
No, he's not. He was commentating.
That's right. Yeah, he was commentating. So forgive me for thinking this, but I always assumed that if you're commentating, you're not in the match. But
no, this was a few months after they had that thing with The Undertaker, where he was injured for a while and he could hardly do anything, and it led to him just abruptly leaving and coming back as the underbiker. And he'd do a thing where he would just sit on commentary and watch the Big Show lose the tag titles on their behalf and stuff. So, yeah, again, it's got Russo's footprints all on him. They've had him roll into the ring and get the pin. You know, Douglas, I'm sure Douglas enjoys doing an impression of his entire last ECW world title reign where he was injured and hardly did fuck all. You know, that helped kill the company, if you ask me, because they couldn't pull the trigger on Taz, and by the time they pulled the trigger on giving the belt to Taz, no one cared about the title change. People cared about RVD, and then they never pulled the trigger on RVD. And I'll stop this side rant, but yeah, this is what Douglas, you know, I'm a franchise fan a lot of the time, but it seems a lot of the time what he brings to the table is swear words in his promos and not actually wrestling when he's supposed to. And managing targets.
Yes, of course. Going off on one little sidetrack, the only time I think it's ever worked where a wrestler has been commentating in his own match that I can think of was back in the days of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, when they had squash matches and you had the tag team of Chris Candido and Brian Lee, and the whole gimmick was that Candido, in a squash match, Candido would leave the ring apron and go on to commentary, and when the commentators would ask him why are you doing this, he'd be, Brian can handle this, don't worry. And he'd just leave Brian Lee to get on with the match while he commentated, and eventually the team split because Lee worked out that he was being taken advantage of. But that was always good. It was at this point, though, after four matches, that I had to take a break from StarCade.
Break number one.
Yeah, my brain was hurting, basically.
Yeah, don't blame you.
Yeah. So we then go backstage again, and we see that the Misfits have locked Oklahoma in a shark cage that they handily have brought with them and have a backstage, because, you know, I always bring a shark cage with me.
Yeah.
And
I assumed that match was coming up next when you touched upon that segment they had before. But no, apparently we're going to have 13 matches tonight, and we're going to have a Misfits segment between every match.
Yeah, sure. Why not? It means that, you know, we can cut a minute or two off the match. Brilliant. So we have Vampiro versus Steve Dr. Death Williams. And even Scott Hudson states that we're only an hour into this pay-per-view, we've already seen everything. The stipulation for this, because everything's got a stipulation, is that if Vampiro wins, he gets 5 minutes in the ring with Oklahoma. Oklahoma's brought out in his cage. He's got a headset on, so he's part of the commentary team. Because as you said earlier on, that he is, you know, his entire gimmick is, and his commentary and everything is designed to mock Jim Ross. He's wearing a black cowboy hat, has a black shirt and with OK written on it in the style of the WWE Attitude Era logo. And it's just cringeworthy and desperate looking. And the sad thing is, all the while that this is going on, you've got Steve Williams, one of the greatest wrestlers of his generation, being used as a backdrop for this whole thing.
Thankfully, Steve appears to have been aware of the situation at WCW, because this was at a time where bookings in Japan, throughout the 90s, being booked in Japan was very lucrative. And especially in the days of New Japan versus All Japan, it was very important that you kept your reputation intact, even when you were wrestling stateside. And Steve knew where his bread was buttered, so he got offered a contract to make some nice money with WCW. He still had the privilege to be able to go to do his Japanese tours. And yeah, he was aware of this because, by all accounts, according to the Wrestling Observer and a couple of other places, he was meant to actually lose by pinfall, and he put the kibosh on that. So he got disqualified, which led to, so that way we got the extra match anyway, because we need more matches on this show, don't we?
Yes, absolutely.
But at least Steve was smart about it. He made sure that his real interest in Japan, because obviously that's that is where he'd make the most of his money.
Yes.
In the 21st century, while he was still a wrestler, he made sure to keep that protected and just treated this like the job that it was.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, because Steve Williams is from Oklahoma, and I think I'm right in saying he was pretty good friends with Jim Ross anyway, wasn't he?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure the situation. I'm guessing, did they speak maybe? And he's like, look, they're going to do this, they're going to make me do this. And Jim's like, right, you're not doing it, make your money. I don't know, maybe. I'm not quite sure off the top of my head.
But basically, yeah, as you say, it's a DQ finish. Williams is ground and pounding Vampiro, throws referee Charles Robinson down, gets disqualified for it, so Oklahoma's got to face Vampiro. And then I don't know if this is part of the story or just a WCW screw up, but Oklahoma is still locked in the cage as the 5 minutes is ticking down. So they're screwing up their own stipulation basically, but he wants Vampiro because Vampiro's been beaten down by Steve Williams. So he's commentating on the match whilst stomping him all over, a bit like the old Ronnie Garvin stomp. And of course, if, you know, after a moment or two, Vampiro recovers sufficiently to get his licks in on Oklahoma, as do the Misfits. So you've got basically an unathletic writer being beaten up by a grunge band, and Vampiro pins him with the nail on the coffin Michinoku driver.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to keep that young pup strong, haven't you?
Oh man!
Please move on. Please.
Let's move on to match number 7. Which after the last match, we've got another match now. We're full of Russo inside ribs and a female bodybuilder valet wrestling. We have Creative Control, who are Ron and Don Harris, who I don't think have really been. They did all right as the Bruise Brothers in ECW, but they've never really drawn much or had many people pay much attention to them. But here they are called Gerald and Patrick, which is a rib on Gerald Briscoe and Pat Patterson. And Virgil, or Vincent, is now renamed Shane, as he's been, you know, renamed after Shane McMahon. Now, the thing is, when he was Virgil, I think there are very few people watching who knew that Virgil was the real name of Dusty Rhodes. But by the time, you know, he came to WCW as Vincent, it was blindingly obvious what was going on, and the subtlety was lost. But creative control and Kurt Hennig against Harlem Heat and Midnight. This is a six-person tag. And the heel, this mysterious heel stable, they're known as the Powers That Be. Again, Vince Russo obsessed with like internal wrestling politics. No one really seems to care about them, and much like the last match, it's a waste of the talent of a great wrestler, this time Kurt Hennig.
And Booker T.
And Booker T, yes. I mean,
despairs in both of this. Yeah.
Booker T, who is getting better and better and better by this stage. Steve Ray's nowhere to be seen, so and this was also a six-man tag to decide the number one contenders for the tag titles. Go and figure that one out.
I've got an answer for you, Dean.
Yeah.
Because WCW.
Ha-ha! That'll be why. So the Harris brothers are wrestling in shirts and ties. And we have another person who's barely trained as a wrestler in Midnight, wrestling on a pay-per-view after the appearance of the Misfits. And then obviously, you know, by comparison, we've got people who are trained wrestlers in the opening match being portrayed as non-wrestlers. Yay! Steve Ray finally appears. No reason is given for him for his tardiness.
He disapproved of Midnight.
He was
not a fan of being associated with her, apparently. So he was like, this led to a really horrible breakup of Harlem Heat, which should never have been reunited in the first place, because obviously they did a split in 98. Steve, you know, they managed to cast off Steve Ray to the NWO Hollywood. Booker T had his chance for single star, and they went straight back to it within a year. And now they're trying to do the split again, and it's even worse than the first split, basically.
Yeah, once you've seen a team split once, it's never going to be, you can't go back to the same thing again. It's without losing.
I don't know. Don't say that. The Hardys have pulled off about seven times now.
I suppose if you leave enough time behind between it. Although, any time the Hardys have split, people never really wanted to see them face each other.
No, funnily enough, the last time they did a split, it was the first time people cared. It was with all the Broken Universe. That stuff was fantastic. But
that was brilliant, yes.
But yeah, you notice how often Dean and I are talking about other stuff and drifting off onto other stuff that we'd actually want to watch with our spare time. I hope you five listeners are all grateful for this.
Yes. They should be. Stevie Ray is told by Booker to leave, but he sticks around at ringside anyway. Kurt Hennig hits Booker T with brass knuckles right in front of the referee, Nick Patrick, who's miraculously recovered from his lethal Tongan death grip earlier. And typical WCW move of the director manages to miss the three count by focusing on Midnight trying to get into the ring instead.
To be fair, by WCW production standards, I'm shocked it took them till match 7 to miss an important part.
This is very true. So what do we have after a match, Liam?
More shenanigans?
Yeah, we've got another video package.
Video package! That was second on my family fortunes list.
We have a video package of Dustin Rhodes renouncing his 7 gimmick and reverting to his real name. So the 7 was kind of all black leather with a white painted face and black eyes, wasn't it?
Yes. But if I remember correctly, just as they're about to pull the trigger on the gimmick and have him make his first in stadium appearance, someone from Standards and Practices politely pointed out that there were heavy overtones of paedophilia about the character it was based on, and because they had the segments where he was peeking through a window at a kid. This actually aired on Nitro as a vignette to build up to this character, and so they did that old classic Russo staple that it weren't even the first time he'd done it with Dustin Rhodes, let alone with other people, where he comes out in his gimmick but immediately trashes the gimmick and says, I'm just going to be myself, my real name here. And this is one of the most famous ones of that, but thankfully Not long after that, all crap happened. It meant the end result was Dustin Rhodes was being Dustin Rhodes, which in WCW, you remember, you know, we did Wrestle War 92 last. We remember some of that early 90s stuff. Dustin Rhodes being himself in WCW is not a bad thing, even when his dad is trying to overbook him. So it led to what I thought, and this is the match we've got now, it led to a good thing with him and Jeff Jarrett, which is a very natural feud. Two good workers who can brawl, and obviously it's got to have something to do with Dusty, so it's a bunkhouse match.
Yeah, because obviously the reason that we were doing the Starrcade this time around was because WWE have just done a big sort of house show that they called Starrcade in South Carolina, in the Carolinas. And I don't know if you saw the video actually of Dustin Rhodes. He came out as Gold Dust, the Gold Dust music, took the hood of his robe off, and he was wearing his Dustin Rhodes kind of gear underneath, and came out to the old WCW theme tune and wrestled that match as Dustin Rhodes to a huge pop.
Yeah, it was very cool, especially when he didn't do a shoot promo like he did on Nitro.
Yes. I'm just looking on the Wikipedia page about that, and yeah, the gimmick was reported to have been based on the Strangers from the 1998 film noir Dark City. And then, yeah, as you said, Turner stands and practices express concern the gimmick could be misinterpreted as a child abductor. And then he did a worksheet mocking unrealistic gimmicks, as well as his time as Gold Dust in the WWF, because obviously you've got to knock WWF when you're there. And then he turned heel and became the American Nightmare. But yeah, this match, as you say, bunkhouse brawl, so... It does make me wonder why we had a hardcore match earlier in the night when this is essentially a hardcore match. It's a brawl with them in street clothes, or sort of street clothes. And I always do like that, a street fight where they're in like jeans and t-shirts.
Yes.
It just makes it look different.
That's the one, yeah, this pay-per-view's overbooked to smithereens, but I will say this. But the two hardcore-ish matches... both booked completely different ways, and I can at least appreciate that. Both produced completely different as well, with the backstage thing, and you had like a monster movie feel with Norman running away from men, and now you've got two guys who are, they're portrayed as equals. They can't stand each other, and they want to kick the crap out of each other. And this is right down you and I's alley, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Good old brawl. Always good. And it's a great match. But the crowd already by this stage are so burnt out. They've seen so much, they're barely reacting to anything. One thing that did confuse me was when Dustin Rhodes duct tapes the referee to the ropes and gags him, when the ref just needs to count pinfalls in a bunkhouse brawl. There's no disqualifications. But
I like that, because yeah, you're right. The referee was doing the whole, because you see this. I like this attention to detail in any referee who does this. You know, you have a no DQ match, but the referee will, when the referee tries to be like a moral compass and goes, don't hit him with that chair. And the guy will be like, well, what are you going to do to stop me? He's like, well, nothing, but just don't do it. You always see him protesting, trying to tell off the wrestlers. And in this instance, Dustin took action. It was an amusing little side spot, I thought, especially when he put the tape on his mouth as well.
Yes.
Just to shut up his nagging, because that was the point. He was nagging Dustin to not use weapons when he's allowed to. So he taped his mouth shut.
And that did get a pop from the crowd, I have to say. But this is the opening for Kurt Hennig to come out and rescue the referee. And Hennig then liberally interferes to try and help Jarrett, who is the chosen one, as we're told in commentary. And he helps Jarrett win the match, because they eventually brawl to the entranceway. And I think while Dustin Rhodes is distracted by Kurt Hennig, Jarrett, I believe, did he come off a ladder or come off the entranceway and hits Rhodes over the head with his guitar?
He does foreshadow. I can't believe I'm saying this, but actual foreshadowing.
Yes. So he's up a ladder.
Yeah, believe it or not, there's a few more. It makes you wonder, you know, I'll give credit where it's due if I have to, but it makes you wonder if you've got all this crap being booked by the guy writing it at this time, and then you've got these little nods that we like, and it makes you think, right, surely this is where the wrestlers have had creative license and suggested saying and got it past him. He couldn't have come up with this himself, could he?
He couldn't. Well, you know, even a blind squirrel finds a nut sometimes. So what follows a match on WCW Starrcade 99?
I'm going to go with video package for 50 then.
And you would be correct, Liam. Take your 50.
Yes.
This is a brief video package to keep us up with the next storyline, which is the feud between DDP and David Flair, which has led to what just has Russo written all over it. It's a crowbar on a pole match.
On a pole, bro.
On a pole.
Pull it on a pole, bro.
No. Not as good. Now, was it Russo who booked Judy Bagwell on a pole, or was that someone else? I lose track.
He would have, but they actually changed it to Judy Bagwell on a forklift.
Yes.
Because the gimmick being that she was too big and fat to be on a pole. More misogyny.
Yay. Now, let's face it, David Flair should not have been anywhere near a pay-per-view wrestling match.
No, this match runs like 3.5 minutes. It's not a long match at all. And DDP is notorious for rehearsing his matches move by move. You can have an opinion, you can like it or you can dislike it, but usually that ensures that his matches go very well, you know, and they're decent, they're never terrible because they've got everything down. And even though he's only required to work 3 minutes and he's working with a micromanager, David Flair still struggles to keep up.
Yes, I've got to say that I won't say who, but I've worked with two different British wrestlers who have literally mapped their match out move for move for move, and I've hated it myself. But there you go, it's just each their own. It just makes me uncomfortable because it's like if you've got move 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, if you forget move number 2, then you're thinking, now what's move 3, or should I go back to move 2? Whereas if you just sort of have a rough outline of things and just take it as it comes, much easier.
And if number 4 doesn't sit well with the crowd, then your entire rehearsed match is gonna fall to pieces as well, because you have to be able to call these things on the floor. I agree with that, but
A start and a finish, and maybe a couple of bits in the middle, and then the rest of it you judge by ear.
Yeah, and I get that, and I also get, like, you know, because I'm a DDP fan, so I get the whole micromanaging. But yeah, if you're ever gonna support the micromanaging aspect, it would be to protect someone like David Flair, who shouldn't be wrestling on Starrcade in the first place, and even that wasn't having the desired effect. And they've got a crowbar gimmick, and that's still not enough.
But then David Flair jumps DDP and attacks him with the golden crowbar that was delivered to him earlier, so that renders the entire stipulation of the match pointless because he's already got a crowbar.
Yeah.
They're about to call off the match, but DDP refuses. The match goes on. And, you know, during this, I just thought how he'd fallen. The previous year, he'd been main event in pay-per-views with mainstream celebrities, and now he's in a mid-card feud with David Flair.
They gave him a great win over the Giant. He had a good feud against the Giant, and he beat the Giant clean with, like, a diamond cutter off the top rope in one of the main matches of Starrcade 98. So it just goes to show what had happened in the year, like, in between. And yeah, he didn't deserve this. But this was stemming off. He had a feud with Ric Flair just after Russo arrived. He was feuding with Flair, and that had all sorts of gimmicks it didn't need, because the two of them could have the promos and the matches that would entertain.
Yeah.
And they had this gimmicky fit, and it carried on. It tailed off into a segue where he was feuding with David, and to be fair, like, David Flair would actually get watchable, not in the ring. He was never a good wrestler. He weren't even I don't even think he reached levels of being titled a bad wrestler. He was just horrific. But I did like what would come in a few weeks after this. They'd pair him up with Devon Storm, a very reliable worker who, you know, never really got his chance. And he went deranged, called himself Crowbar because of the crowbar gimmick. Those two were entertaining, and Daphne as well, who's always great. So finally David Flair was bearable on a TV screen, but we're one pay-per-view away from that still at this point. And thankfully the match doesn't last long, because there's not really much from an in-ring perspective. I think you covered it with the pre-match attack.
Flair finally gets the crowbar off the pole, and literally the moment he gets the crowbar, he's hit with a diamond cutter and pinned. DDP beats him up some more before David Flair is saved by a mystery woman who, as you said, ends up being Daphne, who is one of the great underrated characters in wrestling, I thought. I always liked Daphne. But this whole thing was just a waste of time to me.
Yeah, no, it really was. And it didn't take up much time, yet it still felt like it took up too much. You want DDP on a card like this, but there's got to be something better he can do. There's so many matches you could just take out half the participants and pair up the decent guys. You know, imagine if they put Booker T and DDP in a match.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So then we have another brief video package that sets the scene for match number 10, which is the total package, as Lex Luger is now known, against Sting. And Sting is being accompanied by Elizabeth, and there's a woman involved in this match, so you know what's happening.
Yeah, I've got to say one thing. We know what's happening, but of all the things, I've actually been looking forward to talking about this. So I just wanted to get onto this because, yeah, we touched upon this before, and we will talk about it a lot, because half of WCW's pay-per-views that feature Sting invariably show him up to be a gullible schmuck. And, you know, he got turned on and he fell for tricks and gimmicks throughout his WCW career, didn't he? And he always got made out to be just such a schmuck. Yes. It's a shame because, you know, Sting was one of the most popular guys going. He was never the man, but he was always, you know, he's one of my favourite wrestlers. And it makes you think just how much better he would have done if they'd not made him out to be such a gullible Gus.
Well, you got him kicked out of the Horsemen in 1990. You had the whole thing with the NWO and then becoming the Crow in 96, 97.
Got turned on by Ric Flair at Halloween Havoc 95, which was so blatantly a Horsemen reunion. And he was the only guy who seemed to think that the tag match weren't going to end in a 3-on-1 beatdown with Arn and Pillman and Flair. And then my favourite one was when he was opening all those presents. I think we mentioned this on the Wrestle one.
The giant box Abdullah the Butcher was inside.
Every week he opened up a giant box and Abdullah the Butcher would beat the crap out of him. And then the last one, it was Medusa who did a dance for him, which left him prone to get beaten up by Lex Luger, which led to their feud. So every time you saw him, he was an idiot, and it's such a shame. But there were two glorious moments where he was the smarter guy and he had the upper hand. There was a very good little segment, and we'll get onto this like when it's relevant, but he basically tricked Rick Rude into signing a contract for a world title match using some groupies and an autograph stunt, which I always love. It was one of my favourite Saturday night moments. And this pay-per-view, this match, because there was a segment beforehand, wasn't there, where, you know, he's got, so Elizabeth is Lex Luger's manager, Lex Luger mistreats her, Sting comes and goes, oh yeah, you know, come with me, we'll be alright, because I think those two, you know, you had that ill-fated Sting heel turn, where him and Lex Luger turned on Hulk Hogan, and it didn't last long because it was a failure, so then they started feuding with each other. Elizabeth comes over, and before the match, he replaces her tin of mace with a super potent high octane mace to make sure that Lex Luger can't hurt her, and she takes it. And then I'm going to skip to, I hope you don't mind me skipping to this, because it's not like there's much happening in the matches anyway when Russo's writing about them. The time comes where she hops up on the apron, aims it at Sting, and it's silly string.
Yes.
And I loved it. I won't lie. You know, it's Rusorific, but it actually worked, because to see all the stuff they made Sting do, and for once he outsmarted them, it's just a shame that, you know, after he outsmarted, he got the crap kicked out of him anyway. But
Elizabeth's face as well. You know, there have been so many times in the past where Elizabeth's selling and facials have been awful. But in this instance, it's brilliant because it's not overdone. It's not over the top. It's just like, oh shit, I've been caught out.
Hand in the cookie jar, proper.
Yeah, it is fantastic. It really is good. What I also got to mention as well as a side note was that not only is Luger now called the total package rather than Lex Luger for no apparent reason, he's got new entrance music as well.
Yes, they got rid of his awesome generic rock riff that he had for a few years. I love that theme.
Yes, it was brilliant. And they've got this other kind of futuristic-y kind of thing. And the trouble is, it completely exited my mind until I heard that, and then I realised that that music haunts me, because, and I don't know if you're at this as well, but in March, I looked it up. It was March 2000. WCW did a house show tour, and they did a show at the London, somewhere in London, might have been the London Arena, I can't remember exactly where, and people's luggage had gone missing, and some guys were wrestling in like football shorts and stuff. But Luger's music, he, for whatever reason, he took ages to come out, and his music was playing for, it must have been almost 5 minutes until he finally came out. And I mean, the whole house show was bloody awful anyway. And it was really an indication that WCW was dying. One of the memories of that house show that I had previously, until watching Starcade, had managed to delete from my memory, was that music just playing over and over and over while everyone waited for Lex Luger to turn up for the main event.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't attend any of that particular, I don't know what you're talking about, it was the false advertising. Yeah, I managed to get to the Nitro taping at London Arena later that year, which you were at that as well, weren't you? Yeah,
but you see me on camera.
Yeah, you didn't see me on camera, thankfully. I was up in the heavens, but yeah, that music, I think the whole thing was they're emphasising the bodybuilder aspect, because he'd come out in the spotlight and just pose. And have that big epic music. Oh, what a body he's got! Because, which is fair enough, because at this stage his body is all he's got left. You know, he was a great worker in the 80s, and you know he weren't bad in the early 90s. But at this point, he's nothing. And
he's 41 by this stage.
Yeah, and this is why we're glossing over the mechanics of the match, because you know it's obviously wrestling's de-emphasized. These two aren't really the best at wrestling at this stage anyway, and that whole silly string gimmick was the best thing to happen. But yeah, so that happens, and then they just beat the crap out of him anyway. And I believe, because they do the thing, don't they, where they put they put Sting's arm in a chair and shatter his arm. And this became a thing, because you know, for the next few months, while when Russo got fired and Kevin Sullivan and the booking committee were taking charge and leading us through 3 months of the most turgid programming you could imagine, which included those UK shows you're talking about. They were doing the gimmick, weren't they, with Flair and Luger team package, where they would break everyone's arms.
Yeah.
So I think this was the start of that. So at least it has some significance. A great angle and the start of that. Yeah.
I've got to say as well, there's a bit after the silly string incident where Elizabeth hits Sting with his own baseball bat while Sting's attempting to put Luger in the Scorpion Deathlock, and it seems to me that she gave him an almighty smack with this bat.
Yeah, and
she properly hits him in the jaw with it.
It was really stiff, but you could also see the bat bend, which exposes what they use for those things.
Yes, it's rubber, not anything else. But even so, it was a hell of a shot she gave him.
Compensates.
Yes. At this point, I had to take another break from Starcade. Right.
So you are now on the last leg. This is your.
Yes.
This is how you finished up.
Yeah, I've got 3 matches to go, I think.
Ah.
So it's now time for the powerbomb match between Sid Vicious and Kevin Nash. beforehand, of course, we have another video package, and they show some of the promos. Sadly, they've edited out Sid saying the line of because he says, "I'm twice the man you are," but they edit out where he says, "I've got half the brain you have."
Never fear, Dean. That's been immortalised in our intro. Don't you worry.
In our intro music, indeed. Why they decided that Sid Vicious, aged 39 at this point, should be dubbed the Millennium Man, who says, "I've got 2,000 ways to beat you," when he's actually got one, is absolutely beyond me. Out of all the people they could push as being the future of wrestling, they choose 39-year-old Sid.
Yeah, for a while he was also trying to replicate the Goldberg streak, only he was like losing every house show match he had. And I think like they were blatantly buffing the numbers, but to be honest, I think the idea was he was inflating the numbers on purpose, as like obviously he's a heel, so he wins one match and it goes up by five. So I think they played up to that. But at this point, obviously, I can't keep up for it. But he turned babyface, obviously, and Nash is back after losing a Loser Must Leave WCW Forever match and lasted 2 months, and obviously Hall's by his side. But that's all, to be honest, that's the meat, that and the Half the Brain promo is the meat of what I can remember about this, other than the finish of this match, which is one of my favourite match finishes in WCW history. It's fucking atrocious.
Yes, we'll get to that in one sec.
You mean we have to discuss the match as well? Oh,
well, crap. I was just going to say, Sid, one thing that really annoyed me about Sid, apart from the fact that he stabbed Arn Anderson and stopped me from seeing him wrestle, was I did eventually, because it was the 93 WCW tour, and yeah, they had to rearrange the card. We did get Flair and Rick Steamboat against the Hollywood Blondes, however.
Nice.
And I did finally kind of get to see Arn Anderson wrestle when I was at WrestleMania 18, and he interfered in the Ric Flair Undertaker match and hit a spinebuster on the Undertaker. So, you know, it kind of works out. But one thing that really annoys me about Sid is he has this really stupid, vacant look on his face the moment while he's waiting for his opponent to hit an offensive move on him. Or if he's about to get punched, he'll have that look on his face and lean his head forward. It really annoys me. I just had to say that.
Yeah, he got over such a... And he was over all of his career because of how awesome he looked, you know, how he naturally looks and how he would look while destroying jobbers. And then they'd have him in competitive matches, and it was stuff like what you just described was exactly why it didn't translate and go over the top. You know, once he actually had to put together a competitive match, he looked gauntless and that aura was broken. And that, yeah, that's on show here. And then he's the fact that he's up against a very lazy, unmotivated opponent is not exactly going to be Big Van Vader versus Stan Hansen as far as big man tussles go, is it?
No. One other, if we're just to go off on another tangent, I remember going, when I was a smart ass teenage fan, going to a WWF show at the Royal Albert Hall, I think when I was 17 or 18. And
was this the Battle Royal at the Royal Albert
Hall?
No,
that was 91. This was 90.
That was my first.
Sid had rejoined WWF at this point. Maybe it was 95, actually.
Yeah. So I was at the 94 one.
Okay, I can't remember who else was on.
We'll have to discuss this off.
Yes. But basically, me and my mate were front row. And because this was before the internet, it was like the days where you'd find out on the grapevine when tickets were going on sale, and you'd phone up and just get it over the phone before anyone else, and you'd always get good tickets. And we made up a banner where we just got two pieces of card, cut them into the shape of a pair of scissors, got one of those, you know, those split you know, those split pins that you can get like to act as a hinge, put one of them through the middle, wrote Sid on the scissors, and then just as he came out, we were just having these scissors going up and down. He was managed by Ted DiBiase at the time. DiBiase sees it, absolutely pisses himself laughing, goes, "Haha, don't mention scissors to Sid." Sid walks past, stares at it, stares at us, just keeps staring at us and spits on the sign and then walks off.
That is glorious. I love that.
He was fucking... I'll tell you something. It was like... It is heart in mouth time, yeah. But it was good to piss him off.
You thought, and this is topical given the year that this happened. You were fearful that he was going to Eric Cantona, you weren't you?
Yeah, I'd have made a fortune if he had. Anyway, let's gloss over this match. There's not much to it, apart from the fact that Nash hits a sidewalk slam, covers Sid for a two count, and the referee counts it, even though it's the only way to win is via powerbomb. I guess it's just force of habit.
But that's okay, because when we do get to the actual powerbomb...
This is true, yeah. Both men look exhausted about 2 minutes in, and I don't believe it's just them selling either, but this is the slow, plodding match that we expected it to be. Nash is selling big for Sid, probably because Nash has decided Sid's big enough to be selling for.
Or he knows he's going over.
And he, yeah. Shivani calls this the last pay-per-view of the 1900s. I think he means the 20th century. I don't think they had any pay-per-views in 1909. But then, well, do you want to talk us through the end of this match?
Yes, please. All right, so, you know, it's a pretty traditional template to an extent where you have a match where the babyface gets the win, clean as you like. But and the whole purpose of a ref bump in a lot of instances when the ref's down. And then, you know, the ref in this one, so obviously he's taken a hit and he's down, is that, you know, you get the visual of the good guy winning, clean as a sheet, you know, fair and square, but the referee's not there to register it. Then nefarious means cheap win, and you've got, you know, you get the bad guy to prevail for whatever reason, but you protect the good guy. This instance takes the cake. So you have Sid, if I remember correctly, Sid hits a powerbomb while the ref's down, so no one could call it, match ain't over yet. Nash cheats, gets him down in a heap, and goes to hit the powerbomb himself as a referee starts to just stir a little bit. And
what you didn't mention, by the way, is that when Sid does do the powerbomb on Nash, it is pretty much the clumsiest powerbomb ever, and he nearly drops him on his head.
Which would have been karma, because we've covered the whole Giant incident.
Yes.
But yeah, so Nash goes, and I believe, you know, it's hard to tell. I believe this is part of the story. This is part of the script. He is doing this on purpose. He fails to get Sid up. You wouldn't surprise you if he just couldn't do it or couldn't be asked to do it. But the whole thing is he's, you know, he's taken the beating and he can't actually powerbomb Sid. So
yeah, that goes out on him, doesn't it?
Yeah. So he limps over to the referee, dusts him off, looks him in the eye, and goes, "Ring the bell, I stuck him, I got him," and makes a powerbomb motion. And the ref believes him and rings the bell.
Yep.
Which is, it's just as far as horrible finish, like, so bad it's good, as far as I'm concerned. And the best part of this thing...
It's that bad, is it?
The best part of this finish is that I think, in this instance, Art is imitating life, probably inadvertently, because Kevin Nash has just won a major match at a big pay-per-view because he said so. It doesn't get any better than that, does it? Or worse, you know, you can rub that and say worse if you want. It's better or worse depending on your level of sadisticness, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, I like it. I like the fact that it's so bad, it's gone past bad and is now looped all the way back round into good.
There's a lot of crap on this show, and there'll be even more crap on other Russo pay-per-views that at some point we're going to have to tackle. But this was... I can look at it, and I know it's terrible when it's happening, but I can laugh. You know what I mean? So, and you take that. When you're watching terrible wrestling, if it can entertain you in a perverse manner, you'll think, or at least it's not making me want to swear off wrestling for a month like some stuff does. So there's that.
Yeah. So we don't have a video package next. We have a brief backstage interview with Chris Benoit. And it's now a ladder match for the Is It Vacant, Isn't It Vacant US title. No one seems to be quite sure if Benoit has actually accepted the belt or the belt is vacant and being fought for now.
I think he's refused it. Promo refused it. And as far as I'm concerned, it was no title reign. They attempted to install him as champ and he's like, no, it's... Let's do this for the vacant belt, which is, you know, if you're clear about it, it's a fair shout to make. You're like, yes. Well, technically, your opponent, the champion, didn't show. You should be champion. And he's like, no, let's do a match for the vacant belt, okay, let's roll. But they can't, even that gets lost in translation because they do it with one promo done. But, you know, we know Chris Benoit, like a lot of guys, can talk, but they can't cut a promo. So if you want them to get across something like that, you need someone to help, or you need to be very clear. So that didn't come across. But thankfully, we've got what's coming up is what I found, and I'm sure you would agree with this, the best match on the card.
Yes.
By country mile, although the bunkhouse match and the opener were enjoyable, but this is by far the best match on the card.
The Norman Smiley match was highly entertaining, but in a different kind of way. So, Scott Hudson says Chris Benoit is a man of ethics and pride, which kind of sounds awkward nowadays. Yeah, again, looking back on 1999 with 2017 eyes. So let's see who his opponent will be. Oh, look, it's another appearance on the show by Jeff Jarrett, who gets very little reaction coming out because people have seen so much of him.
Russo did shove him down people's throats, and it'd get worse in the New Blood era. But on this instance, I mean, when you're put in a bind, who else are you going to have come into this match? It was the right choice.
Oh yeah, he delivers, certainly. I mean, we get some typical ladder match spots like the baseball slide drop kick, putting the ladder into the ribs, catapulting your opponent into a ladder propped up in the corner. Benoit gets cut hard way by his eyes and his nose. There's also a great spot where Benoit puts Jarrett upside down in the tree of woe on the ladder in the middle of the ring, tries to climb up to get the belt, but then Jarrett wriggles to knock the ladder
over. Yeah, he does like an enziguri, doesn't he, on the ladder. If I remember that correctly, doesn't he?
He's at this point, he's upside down. He's just kind of wriggling his legs and wriggling his hips to rock the ladder.
Because am I right in remembering that he's got one leg caught and one leg's kind of free? Or am I thinking of a different match?
I think both of his legs are tied up together,
okay. Because I could have it might have been, because I think it was also like they used it as a big photo in an old copy of Power Slam magazine. Because in fairness, they had a ladder rematch the next night on Nitro that pretty much negates the finish of this one. But there's two ladder matches, so it could have been the other one.
It's the other one then, yeah.
But yeah, I could have sworn I remembered him. Like, so if one leg's caught in the tree of woe, you could kind of, if you turn your body and kind of catch the ladder with your free leg like an enziguri, with the other leg being held like a guy would hold it. I just remember that visual. You're probably right.
He's wiggling his hips to rock the ladder, and that knocks the ladder to the ropes. And later on, a really good move, which wasn't a common move at this point in time, was where Jarrett climbed to the top rope and hit a top rope drop kick into the ladder that sent Benoit crashing to the mat as well. One thing that looked spectacular at the time, and again, benefit of hindsight, horrible to watch, is Benoit climbs up to the very top of the ladder and you think he's going to get the belt, but instead he climbs right to the very top rung and delivers his flying headbutt on Jarrett. And it's like, knowing the damage that move does, I mean, look at what's happened to Dynamite Kid. Harley Race says he wishes he'd never popularized the move. And obviously what happened later on with Chris Benoit and concussions and stuff, it's kind of really awkward to watch nowadays, but at the time, absolutely spectacular.
Yeah, it is number one, my least favourite move in wrestling. I despise the flying headbutt. All the reasons you mentioned, and what makes it worse, the cherry on the cake for me, is the sacrifices people make to their neck and their head, especially in what we know about CTE. The sacrifices people make to do that move, and for me, the move looks like shit. You are making this. I get what you're saying. There's a great visual because they were having Benoit do this in this time era, in the 2 or 3 month period. He was doing this a lot, unfortunately, because I remember him doing it off the top of a cage to Jarrett, which concussed Jarrett and took him out of a pay per view.
Yes.
So he was doing a lot of these visuals because they were Russo was hell bent, and on one that he does try to elevate guys that are popular to his, to sort of credit. And he wanted to take Benoit and make him the main eventer that WCW neglected to do for many years at this point. And a lot of that came down to doing all the, every week he'd be doing a crazier diving headbutt or a better visual. It's always a great visual. But if you watch how it lands, tell me how that's supposed to incapacitate an opponent.
Yeah, it doesn't. It just looks spectacular.
I despise the move.
Yeah. Also, bear in mind that this era as well is the era of the spectacular stunts. WWE doing people falling off the cage in the Hell in the Cell, and the TLC matches with spears off the top rope and off of ladders and that.
Yeah.
And this is the era of the crazy dives and the crazy stunts. So basically, Benoit then climbs back up the ladders to retrieve the belt. fantastic match. He is now officially the US champion, yet within 1 month he'd have won the WCW world title and then left the company.
Yeah, and this particular reign, as I touched upon earlier, lasted a day. Ladder rematch on Nitro. If we ever get to covering Nitros, it's a long way. We've got so many pay-per-views covered, so I might as well quickly graze through it now. If I remember correctly, the rematch, they ran about, I'd say, 8 minutes. And that's quite good for a Russo Nitro. They got 8 minutes of doing good ladder match spots, but only to the point where, do you know, you have a ladder match and you have good wrestling, and then they go and fetch the ladder from ringside and they do spots outside the ring with a ladder and that.
Yeah.
But then it gets to the point in the match where the ladder actually gets into the ring and Jeff Jarrett fakes a knee injury, so Benoit thinks, well, sod you, I'm going to climb the ladder and get the belt, and all the rungs fall through, and it does in a way where the gimmicked rungs are actually not gimmicked enough, and he has to stamp up the ladder rungs like he's just been told off by his parents. He's stamping up the stairs to make a point, right, to really give away he's trying to make these go through. And then he does that, can't get up, and turns around, ladder shot, loses the belt. So yeah, any goodwill from the best match on the show is eradicated if you watch that Nitro afterwards, which is, yeah, and I'll touch upon what else happens on the Nitro after this pay-per-view when we cover what I believe is the last match of 13 left.
Before we've had a video package.
No, of course not. I was never insinuating that we wouldn't have a video package, Dean. My word.
I do apologise. I stand corrected, Liam. final match, Bret Hart v Bill Goldberg. Goldberg, but Bret Hart keeps referring to him as Bill Goldberg in the interviews. And by this point in time, the fans aren't even reacting to Michael Buffer's intro. Now, I know we've discussed Michael Buffer before, but one thing you have to say about him is the "Let's Get Ready to Rumble" line always gets an intro, except for this show, because the fans are just so burnt out from everything that Vince Russo has thrown at them for the past 2.5 hours.
I mean, do you know what? You could have had 12 matches preceding this that were of WrestleMania X7 quality, and they'd still be cream crackered, because that's a lot to put in. You want ideally 7-8 matches.
Yeah.
Ideally on a 3-hour pay-per-view, because it's a lot to process, as we touched upon earlier. Yeah. You know, loads going on. You forget stuff. It all becomes a blur. Bit of slow-paced deliberation always works. And at this point, the selling point of the pay-per-view, and it's going to be an afterthought to the live crowd. And we've always discussed just what it does to how memorable a match is if the crowd doesn't care.
And even if you just have a couple of matches with no real story behind them, other than number one contendership for a certain belt or something like that, where it's just two guys fighting to be the top contender. Since the undefeated gimmick ended, Goldberg didn't seem to be quite as over as before. But I think that that's always going to happen when you get beaten once, but
it's perpetually injured as well.
The way he got beaten.
Yeah, we could go on forever about the loss of the streak, and I agree with you on that. He had a few injuries as well, because he was out all summer, I believe. And then a couple of weeks after this, he'd smash his forearm through a real glass window.
Yes.
And be out even for 6 months more. So that derailed things. And he was in the middle of this. But while he was active, they tried to run one of the few money matches they had left, which was Bret Hart Goldberg, and they did that. I remember that angle they did ages ago in almost another universe, and it was only 9 months before this where Hart issued a challenge to Goldberg. Goldberg came out, speared him, and he had the metal plate under his hockey jersey.
Metal plate, yes.
Other than that, and they called that a match, but it was an angle, not a match. You know what I mean? Other than that, I think this is the first time unless I stand to be corrected, I should say, I think this is the first proper one-on-one match.
Yeah.
And, we know these two can work. We know Bret Hart can hold a match together. Goldberg, if he's being held together, when we covered the DDP Goldberg main event from Havoc 98, hold him together, he carries his end. And, for the most part, it's a good... there's not much story. It's come out of the blue. It's two baby faces, so it's a bit tepid, even without the mass burnout. But
I mean, it tells a simple but effective story. You've got Brett the wrestler trying to wrestle Goldberg, and Goldberg trying to use his size and his power to his advantage, you know, with press slams and stuff like that.
And his kicks to cripple his opponent. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself, aren't I?
Yeah. Goldberg tries his awkward-looking rolling leg scissors submission thing without ever having worked on Brett's ankle in the match, but in a really nice spot. Brett then counts it into a sharpshooter in an attempt, which is, I think, is really good because it just shows, you know, Brett's always trying to win the match as a champion.
Yeah.
They brawl to the outside, and the ref, I don't know if it's Nick Patrick or not, but the referee gets bumped, but only after remembering his spot and very awkwardly running into position at the last moment, which A makes no sense and B looks terrible. So we've got our referee down, and Charles Robinson then comes down to referee. Yeah, it was Nick Patrick first one. Charles Robinson comes down, and almost immediately he gets bumped too. And it just doesn't seem to be needed in this match.
No, and we didn't count the ref bumps from the show so far, but there were a few.
There's been at least two other matches, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, several ref bumps and one ref taping up.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it just doesn't. It just takes away the credibility of a world title match main event. Third referee comes out, Johnny Boone. Never heard of him. Never seen him before.
Never heard of Johnny Boone?
No.
Oh, when we get the chance, we're going to have a chat about this. Don't worry. Johnny Boone's going to come up on other of those pay-per-views. Obviously, we're 13 matches and 90 minutes in, so we won't do that now.
Johnny Boone's
time will come.
Yeah, well, stay tuned for a future episode, which will be Because WCW, the Johnny Boone special.
Yes.
Goldberg misses a spear, hits the ring post, and at this point the crowd start coming alive a bit because it's like, you know, something's happening here. But, you know, this is, apart from the ref bumps, put them aside, it's a well-worked match. It tells a good story. Brett works on the legs and the knees of Goldberg, keep him on the ground, negate his power, soften him up for the sharpshooter. Johnny Boone then gets bumped. Goldberg then hits that infamous mule kick to Bret Hart's head. Nails the spear. We have no referee. And obviously that was the kick that ultimately ended Bret Hart's wrestling career.
Of all the things we've slated about this pay-per-view in general, and obviously this was an accidental thing. It's not a deliberate scripted part, but obviously it's the most sobering part to know that kick effectively robbed us of eventually getting dream matches such as, you know, I know it would have taken some doing and certain things to go the way, but I really like to convince myself if that hadn't happened, we could have got Bret Hart, Kurt Angle and such in certain realms, even if just in like TNA, so, you know, anything could have happened.
I mean, he was robbed of it. Yeah, he was 42 by this point, but so he'd have had a few more years left in him, probably. Not that many, but
Hart could have gone to his 50, I reckon, his style of work.
Then it's a matter of if he'd have wanted to carry on at a certain level or not, you know, but we shall never know, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So because we've got no referee, because, you know, Goldberg's gone for the spear, but there's no one to count it, Roddy Piper, who just strolls to the ring wearing a referee shirt. Goldberg gets distracted by this. This allows Brett to attack Goldberg. Bret Hart rolls Goldberg over for the sharpshooter. And before the move is even cinched in, Piper calls for the bell to replicate the Montreal Screwjob, which happened over a bloody year ago. Leaves the ring. Bret Hart chases him down, and a bored-looking, emotionless Piper hands him the belt and walks off. And that is the outcome of your main event of the biggest show of the year for WCW, harking back to an event that happened in a rival promotion over a year ago, and the crowd are booing, not in a good way, for an awful ending. And do you know what? When I finished watching that show, where, like, you know, two of the three main matches didn't have a proper conclusion, it wasn't a surprise that WCW folded. It was a surprise that it managed to last another 15 months before it happened, basically.
Yeah, so the gap between, and obviously we took the time to do like a War Games special, and we made sure to do a Starrcade here because we just had a War Games, just had to return Starrcade. But at the start of this, because WCW project, we're looking just to do like a Cliff's Notes accelerated timeline of their from their very peak to when they went out of business. And we've gone 14 months between episode 3, which was Halloween Havoc 98, and here, Starrcade 99. And you take that 14 months again, and WCW is very much up for sale and a month away from being bought by WWE, which speaks volumes. I'm going to very quickly offer you some context for what you've just described happened in that main event, Dean. I know, normally when I offer you context, it's you say like, oh, this was weird, this made no sense. And I offer context, you're like, all right, well, I kind of, you know, it makes a little more sense now. I see what they're going for. I'm going to offer you context, and it's not going to help in the least bit. But this is what was actually happening. This is what happened. So
I was just going to say, basically, with these shows, when I go in and watch them, I don't read up beforehand. I don't look at the results. I watch it all with fresh eyes as such to try and get, you know, a proper reaction. So sometimes I'll miss things. Sometimes I'll get a good gut reaction like I just had watching the end of that show.
On the other hand, my long-term memory is considered by some as a gift and by me as a burden. And and just it works on a trigger series, like covering this event and just looking back up at the results of this event reminded me of watching this event, which meant I didn't need to rewatch it. And it reminds me of a chain reaction of all the Nitros and the Worldwides and the Thunders and all that crap. So I do remember that I had this powers that be where Russo was the new boss, but he never appeared, like his face never appeared on TV, and you didn't know his name in storyline, and you just hear his voice, his grating fucking voice. And he would be demeaning.
That's right, because he's on the powers that be pro. He's a faceless voice at the other end of the camera.
He is indeed.
The powers that be, yes.
And one of his pet projects was antagonizing Roddy Piper, and he demoted him to referee and had him doing all these tasks. And you know, so he technically is a referee at this stage. For whatever it, and like it was barely covered in on the ensuing Nitro the next night, but. You know, he has forced Roddy Piper to do this, and you're not. So you know, Roddy Piper comes out with a face like, I don't want to be here. I'm about to do something. Come on, hey. So he gets that. You know, he's good at what he does, Roddy Piper. So he conveys like the emotion of like, you know, I'm a slave to my boss here or whatever. And he goes on and he does this, and then he tries to explain it to Goldberg and have a row on the Nitro, and the rematch is set, because I think almost all these matches were rematched on Nitro. It's another thing he used to love doing.
Yeah.
And so I had the rematch, which is where the Outsiders, Jeff Jarrett, come out and beat the crap out of Goldberg, and Brett's in on it. He's part of the NWO and the NWO reform.
This is NWO 2000.
And this is what Russo's been saying. This is big money. Everything he's been doing since he took over in October has been building towards this, rehashing Bischoff's idea. And Piper tries to come out and save Goldberg and gets destroyed as well. So he sides with Goldberg. He's a good guy, and yet he came out and did this anyway. It makes no sense. Like it sounds like I'm missing something in the description, but I'm not. But I just wanted to. I went to make clear what was going on here with the whole Roddy Piper refereeing. It was literally, this is how he tried to piece together an excuse to do the NWO and the Montreal Screwjob in one go. And that's what we got. And that's why the company was in pieces for the next few months. And that's why they fell further in pieces when they thought they'd save it from being in pieces by going back to Russo combined with Bischoff. And that's why by the time they got their act together, in about a year from there, they started putting on bearable shows with good cruiserweights again and some all right stuff going on above it. At least it was watchable again, but days were numbered. In the meantime, I don't suppose you want to finish on a slightly less depressing note and give us a Dean's Dream theme, do you?
A Dean's Dream theme. Well, yes. Shall we press play and see what I've chosen?
Here we go.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to say about this theme first off.
Do you recognise this theme, first of all?
No, I'm, and this is the thing. I'm going to be the first one to admit, I had to, you know, you showed me this before we went on, and I needed to see the title of this theme to know whose it was. It didn't stand out to me. I remember a couple of themes associated to Tom's Inc., but this wasn't one of them. And I think one of the things you said to me was that, you know, it shouldn't have been Tom's Inc.'s theme in the first place. And no. I get that. It's not a Tom's Inc. theme, and that's probably why I don't remember it.
It always stuck in my head because, to me, it was, for the standard of music at the time and the standard of wrestling entrance themes, to me, it was always a really, really good tune. But it just didn't fit Tom's Inc. When you think of like what Brian Pillman, who is a very similar wrestler, what Brian Pillman's entrance music was like, which fitted him to a T, and you had this music to me would be someone like, you know, someone a bit of a big swaggering guy, like, you know, if Barry Windham wasn't from Texas, he'd have probably had this music. Do you know what I mean?
Someone like Scotty Flamingo, maybe. Someone like that.
Yeah, someone with a bit of, either someone big and menacing or someone with a bit of swagger, but it just didn't fit the smiling, clapping baby face of Tom's Inc. But as I said, it was, to me, a tremendous tune nonetheless.
Do you know what I think of when I hear this? I think of countless movies that have a scene in a strip club. And I reckon any time an American TV show or movie is in a strip club with all the ladies gyrating with their tits out, this theme song is what is the music that's playing in that club.
So basically what you're saying is I think of Barry Windham if he wasn't from Texas, and you think of women in a strip club gyrating with their tits out.
Well, they've both got massive tits, so
but only one of them is circulating counterfeit money. Right, we will end things there because, ladies and gentlemen, we've taken up enough of your time as it is. Thank you so much for downloading tonight's episode. If you like it, please tell your friends. Please follow us on Twitter at BecauseWCW, or follow us or message us on Facebook, facebook.com/BecauseWCW. Want to say a hello and thank you to WCW Worldwide Twitter account, who have followed us this week and retweeted us. They do big numbers. They're a big account, and it's great to get some recognition from them. And Brian, isn't it, the fellow behind that? He'll be a good person to get on board, maybe. If
definitely. Love to have Brian on board. Not only that, but, you know, the social media is a great account to follow. But check out WCWWorldwide.com. Because really between that, the Wrestling Observer and DDT Digest, which I can assure you is still archived and up and running.
I used to contribute to them.
Yeah, it's no longer like active. They don't post live stuff, but all the archives from the days of those WWE existence is still there. You can go back and read it all. Those three are the sites I go to for my WCW fix. Please check out WCWWorldwide.com. It is brilliant. They do such a good job over there. And it's a pleasure to be in discussions with those guys about maybe having Brian on the show. And
if we can sort out the time differences and all that. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Mate, we'll do a pre-record, whatever it takes. Because, you know, when it comes to WCW nostalgia, there's no better pee in that pod with us, I don't think.
Definitely. Right, well, we'll wrap it up there. As I said, thank you so much for downloading. Please do keep in touch on social media for our next episode, which will be in a few weeks' time. We will be putting a poll up on Twitter to see which 2000 pay-per-view you would like us to cover.
Go easy on us, please.
Yeah, we've just had to sit through WCW Starcade 99, for God's sake. So on behalf of my glorious co-host, Liam Hatt, this is the Twisted Genius, Dean Ayer, saying thank you for joining us. I'll see you ringside.